Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. Fukushima irradiated, and everybody's got a part time job as an incandescent light bulb, allegedly. My very special guest today is the fabulous Joe Atwell. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Vinnie.
Can you tell us just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Well, I'm an author, wrote a book called Caesar's Messiah, and have for the last couple of years been involved in the production of a documentary regarding the book, which will be coming out on the 28th of September. There'll be a theatrical release in an actual movie theater in Beverly Hills, California, of all places. And the book looks like that. And on the 28th, you'll also be able to buy both the book and the DVD, which will be streaming and downloadable. And you can get it on our website, which is caesarsmessiah.com.
And if people have tapped into a higher consciousness, can they download it that way too?
They already have, typically. You don't get to a higher consciousness unless you've already downloaded it.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, so go to the website, ladies and gentlemen, and get your higher consciousness downloaded.
Sure.
Is there a website for it, or is it just being sold on Amazon? Because usually it's difficult to make sure that people can actually hear it. And I wanted to also mention as well to some of the listeners that I've got. We have authors on the show regularly, and now when I have them on, they usually sell a book or three after they come on the show. So just as long as they know what the book is and what it's about, where they can get it, that sort of thing.
Right. There is a website that's, you know, you can go to simply by, you know, keying in caesarsmessiah.com, and the website has the book for sale on the 28th, which is the premiere of the documentary. You'll be able to buy the documentary, but it also has forums for asking questions about the thesis, and it has links to other bits of information regarding Christianity that I think the public would find interesting.
Such as?
Well, I think you'll be able to find quite a bit about the Flavians, the group of Caesars that actually created Christianity. one of the reasons that the actual origins of the religion hasn't become apparent to more people is simply that very few people know the history of the era that the religion was produced in. And if you, from the website, you'll be able to essentially traverse into this world of the Flavian Caesars. One of the things you'll be able to do is go to Professor Rob Blackhurst, who is an Aussie, at least he lives there. And he's done a very good analysis of the era just based on its history that led him to the conclusion that the Flavians produced the religion. And I think if you study Dr. Blackhurst's work, you'll get a good sort of understanding of the basic history of the era. And you sort of need this to have an understanding of the actual Gospels, because the Gospels are about the war between the Romans and the Jews. And so if you don't actually have some understanding of that, then the literature itself is very difficult to comprehend.
So, well, hold on a second. So the Romans made the Bible to control the Jews, even though the Bible's full of the Romans suppressing the Jews, and they just didn't click that these bunch of people that are suppressing us and now giving us a new religion are still trying to enslave us.
Right. The Romans fought a war against a messianic movement in Judea, and this war was the most bloody of the Roman Empire. It lasted from the year 1, as we calculate it, right up to the year 135. It included three just absolute all-out wars and a number of smaller rebellions. The Romans, following the first of these wars, which ended in 73 AD, the group of the family that was in control at that time produced the Gospels, not so much with the idea of controlling the Jews in Judea, but what they were really worried about is the missionary activity of this movement, this military version of Christianity that had led the Jews to these rebellions. Let me just sort of back up and try to give you just some history that might be of use.
Is this the kind of origin of that saying, the onward Christian soldiers saying?
No, I think that comes later. That would probably come during the Crusades and would have been really useful during the Children's Crusade, because you know how difficult it is to get kids to carry weapons.
Well, apparently all you need to do is kidnap them and give them an AK-47 and then get Joseph Kony to train them up. You know, it's all good.
God, what a sad bit that is. Yeah, you know, you're right. I think that sort of studying Christianity gives you a general understanding of really how governments operate. Christianity, just to digress, is really, it looks like a religion, but actually it's a psychop operation. It, as I was saying, it really wasn't, they weren't really trying to convert Jews. They knew that the Jews, who particularly the zealots who are familiar with the Torah and the material in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they weren't going to fall for the fake character Jesus Christ. But what they wanted to do was to stop the missionary activity. The Rome at this time in the first century was a prison of nation states. They had dozens of ethnicities under their thumb. And the Jews rebelled, led by this messianic movement, kicked Rome out and actually established their own nation state. I mean, they had a government, they were minting coins for 3 years. So obviously, Rome could not permit this, because they knew that if this lasted, then all of the prisoners of their nation-state jail would just leave. So they went in and crushed the messianic movement. Now,
Just point of clarification, can you define messianic?
Yeah, it would be an organization that believed in the prophecies in the Torah which predict a world ruler. If you look in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll see that this group specifically looked to a branch of David, you know, son of Jesse, in other words, someone from the house of David, who would be a Messiah, who would essentially have the power of God, and then would lead them militarily. In other words, the real Christ in the first century was a warrior, and this is completely to be expected, because remember, the term Christ, which is just the a Greek way of expressing the Jewish concept of Messiah, the Christ would be someone in the lineage of David. He was the first Christ. He was the first individual who was anointed. Christos means anointed. He was the first individual who was anointed as part of his becoming king. Now, David, of course, is famous for being a warrior. You know, he kills Goliath. He's just a military leader. So the Christ in the first century, many of whom are actually recorded by the historian Josephus, are all military leaders. So this is what a Christ is. It's someone that the Jews who were familiar with the Messianic prophecies would see as having come with the power of God to lead them militarily.
Does it mean that we actually need the power of the gods? But I mean, think about this. I mean, who was I? I forget where I read this, but it was talking about Barack Obama coming into power in messianic fashion. Remember when there was those couple million morons on the mail? Oh, that's a good alliteration there. the thing that really strikes me is it's almost as if the Bible has predicted all these things, but instead of those predictions coming true on their own, the New World Order are manipulating people into accepting the prophecies and making them come true on purpose so that people will stand down, thinking that the rest of the prophecies will automatically come true as well. Like, there's no point resisting, it's all preordained and what have you. Do you see any of that happening?
I couldn't agree more. I think that Christianity has always been a tool of government, and currently the best way government can use it is to inject these apocalyptic ideas to essentially enact foreign policy, which is not in the interest of the citizens, but they're duped into it vis-a-vis their religious beliefs. Let me give you a real good example. George Bush Jr., when he wanted to invade Iraq, he went to the French Prime Minister Chirac, and he said that you needed to join the coalition. And Chirac said, why? And he said, because it's Gog and Magog. Now, Chirac had no idea what he was talking about. After Bush left, he got a Bible scholar to help him understand, and he was told that Bush believed that he was essentially a character from the Book of Revelation, and that he was characterizing the war in the Mideast that he was envisioning as essentially the beginning of the apocalyptic war that is predicted in the Book of Revelation. So you can see that the literature is extremely damaging to human thought, and the sooner it's exposed, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And we were talking about kidnapping of children in terms of child soldiers, and I was just thinking before, nobody knows kidnapping and child mind control like the Vatican.
They wrote the book.
Quite literally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, the Vatican is run by the Pontiff Maximus. That's the official Latin title of the Pope. And it comes directly from the Caesars. The Pontiff Maximus was the title given to the head of the College of Priests at Rome and was an official title of Caesar. Beyond that, the hill that the Vatican resides on was the area that the Caesars had their palace. So you can see that Christianity essentially took Caesar as its head, and he didn't even bother changing his name or his address. He just stayed there The one of the purposes of Christianity was to onset the Dark Ages. The Caesars knew that the more educated a population was, the worse it was for their purposes. So they created the character Jesus Christ for one of the reasons was to essentially just to stupefy the masses, the hoi polloi.
So it's it's the same reason why a magician has a really, really hot assistant on stage with him.
Exactly. Well, I mean, he's the beloved man God. I mean, he's the iconic Jesus Christ. He's so wonderful. The problem is that's the image that's given to the population. They then obey his administrator on earth, the Pope or the Pontiff Maximus. So what happened was that Caesar simply, seeing the propensity for religious belief on the in the part of his citizens, seeing all these rebellions and wars and all this, the cost to him, all he wanted was blind obedience. So they created Christianity. They got people to believe in the character Jesus Christ. That meant that you would do the bidding of his magistrate on earth, who's the Pontiff Maximus. So the end result is the peasant would now pay taxes to Caesar without ever rebelling, because essentially it was a religious act, not something that the Romans were demanding of them and that you might rebel from.
So what part of Jesus' teachings told us to pay taxes blindly, support immoral wars, eat really unhealthy, stop caring about each other, divorce, you know, that kind of stuff? I mean, look, if I were to define everything that the Bible's against, you know, Ten Commandments or whatever, and then you cross-reference what's defined that you should not do with what the churches do, and they match up almost perfectly. It's almost like, do as I say, not as I do. And that's why they don't want an educated population, because they see through the hypocrisy of it.
Exactly. I mean, you've I couldn't say it any clearer. That's exactly what has happened. They give the way that they create the obedience is very subtle. They have obviously studied psychology. They get you to love the character Jesus Christ. Now, when you read something like Jesus saying, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, you are confused. You don't know, you know, well, gee whiz, I worked all year for these crops. How come I have to give half of it to the Roman magistrate, who would just say, well, you know, give to Caesar what Caesar has said. This is what Jesus has told you. Jesus loves you. And so then the serf, because this really is the end result of Christianity, is the Dark Ages and the feudal system, the serf then is become an animal, a Christian animal, that has no more power of sort of even of rebellion, and he just blindly gives his tax or whatever it is that Caesar's demanding from him to the Pope, because that's Jesus's representative. And so now Caesar is able to get what he wants without the bother of constant rebellions and the problems of disobedience.
I know. It's almost it's like an early version of a mind control chip vaccine, you know? We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with my very special guest, Joe Atwell. Back in a minute. The way it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah, and no one like me, yeah, yeah, yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader.
Right, it's
been a long time coming, yo.
Yeah,
but I'm here now. So what you wanna do?
Huh?
How many dudes you really know? Like this, like this, like this. Let's do it. How many dudes you know wrote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, if any, not many, if any. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. Check, check, the mic, check. The 1-2 from a crew coming through. Are you hype yet? Nowadays, everybody wanna talk. We got some scribe. Ain't got nothing when I'm up in the live.
Can't fall. You feeling the vibe? You know, scribe is sticking me high. From the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand. Nice little slave country we've got here with the prime ministerial dictatorship from our fabulous Federal Reserve employee. Quite literally, actually, former employee of the Federal Reserve for 2 years. He was the head of the bond and derivatives trade. So you can know for a fact that he's a globalist whose economic hitman set here to sell the entire country out. And New Zealand's a real beautiful place, full of real nice people. And this frickin' scumbag behind me, John Key, if anybody's watching on the video on YouTube here, it's kind of like being injected with a virus. That's what some people have become, I think. They have become weaponized viruses. And that, I think, is the political game, is figuring out how to infect your mind and infect your country. And the whole idea is we need to find a cure, preferably something natural. Not 100% sure if we'll find it, though. But I think the understanding of the past, and as you put earlier, Joe, the education of people happens to be its threat. And now, with the internet, people no longer need institutions to get their education. It is freely available for them to choose what they wish to learn. This is the downfall, I think, or at least the very beginning of the downfall of the system that has been hanging over humanity for what, best part of a couple of thousand years?
Exactly. And it's going to be interesting to see how long freedom on the internet will last, because it is so directly destructive of the general control of mentality that the oligarchs have implemented through the media to date. You know, people are starting to get into the habit of using the internet to source their own stories, to learn how to actually, to try to determine, just how much truth there is that the in the stories that the media, the general mainstream media, produces. So while it lasts, the freedom of the internet should be used vigorously, and you're to be congratulated for putting a show like this on in New Zealand. And I mean, just to give you my, kind of crude impression, it is just astounding, given the level of financial fraud and the degree that the financing mechanisms that, particularly those centered in our primary banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, have been destructive throughout the world. How in the world is it that so many of the employees of these banks end up in prime minister positions? I mean, if you look at John Key, you have one example, which is just astounding that someone like that would become the prime minister in Zealand. But what about Mario Draghi? I mean, how in the world can so many, ex-employees of Goldman Sachs end up running countries? It's a situation that there is a crisis that requires the citizens to become alert and to start to cross-reference information, go into the backgrounds of people. We have to stop accepting the stories that the media associates with these individuals, who are given to us as our, the choices we have to choose from. I mean, here we have Obama and Romney. Well, we need to really closely look at both of these individuals to see, first of all, do we have a choice? Is there anything really fundamental about these two, or all we really get to vote on are something like same-sex marriage, which is something what I would call a slave issue? It's an issue given to the slaves to vote on, so they have the illusion of democracy, but it isn't real democracy. The real democracy would be having to do with foreign policy and financing. Those issues, it seems to me, that Obama and Romney are essentially been vetted by the same organization.
Yeah, well, it looks like this. Like, for example, would legalizing homosexual marriage stop the country being enslaved by criminal bankers? No.
It's not a burning issue at the moment.
Well, I think the
same-sex marriage, abortion is another absurd issue. It's so clear when you study Christianity, the real origins of the religion, that the oligarchs, if they're going to have control, which is all they care about, they have to control both sides of the dialectic. This is the just sort of fundamental piece of information that the citizens have to defend themselves against the techniques of the oligarchs. The first thing the citizens have to do is to ask themselves, is there a choice being offered us? Is there anything really distinct in terms of the issues that matter between these people that are being given to us? Because the oligarchs know that they have no control at all if they don't control both political parties. So I would just say that that's the first question that should always be asked, and never is, until your show came along. And now we can hopefully solve these problems immediately.
Indeed. And of course, as we talk about deeper connections, what occurred to me as you're saying that is, what is the connection between the financial institutions and the banking institutions? I mean, as far as I know, the Vatican has an enormous interest in the international global financial system, doesn't it?
It does. and it often gets caught up in a scandal that somehow links it directly into the so-called international financial system. But just over months, these stories seem to disappear, and the thing just fades away. But then, you know, it'll rise up again. Certainly, the Vatican is involved in international banking, and certainly international banking has political power and agenda. It has the wherewithal to be able to defend itself, the interest that it sees for itself. And citizens simply should be alert to the possibility that they their influence isn't simply in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, but rather in both parties.
Well, this is true, and this is why on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com /humor, .html, that's /humor.html, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. I've got a whole bunch of pictures, comedy pictures that we've come up with. And one of them is Barack Obama on the one side and Mitt Romney on the other side. Behind them is the 2012 elections, and it's got a big copy of the Constitution. Instead of saying "we the people," it says "me the weevil." And you have Barack Obama and Mitt Romney actually as weevils sitting there with their teleprompters in front of them that say B and S. And below it says U.S. elections picking the lesser of two weevils. And this is what I find has become the thing that discourages most people from becoming politically active or even caring is they have a minimum amount of awareness. Just knowing that you're being scammed makes people not want to participate.
Well, that's true, but it's also that in much of Western civilization, at least heretofore, they've been able to provide enough creature comforts to dumb down the population so that they don't have any particular reason to rebel. I think as we go forward, we're going to see that you know, when people are cold and hungry, they have a different level of political interest. And that's why the internet is so critical to go forward intellectually right now. It really needs to be organizing itself, connecting the alternative media. Internet needs to be finding ways to connect itself. I've been suggesting that all of the shows that really produce independent content find some way to become a network. So that, and they share resources, they share audiences, they try to even, you know, share information so that we can be as effective as possible in using the tool of the internet to get as many people to realize that, I mean, for example, in our country, that you have to look outside of the Democrat or Republican parties for political technique in order to make better your world. That these parties have, you know, systems of control that are, you know, beyond the normal persons, and they're not really looking out for us. So this would be something I would hope would occur, is that that before the real crisis, which will come, I believe, fairly shortly, the internet
now
it's sitting there waiting, and when it happens, what will people do? It'd be nice to have the internet as organized as we can get it so that information can be provided to the citizens so that they can make good choices.
Yeah, this is true. And I wanted to mention something here because you talked about how the alternative media networks need to work together, share resources, things of that nature. Yeah. Well, I'm starting to do that. As far as I know, I'm the only. I haven't seen anybody else do it yet, but I've started the Vinnie Eastwood Radio Alliance. So I've got a whole bunch of other radio show hosts from different networks, different parts of the world, and whatever. Just basically mates of mine, and we get along and have a good time and expose a little bit of scumbaggery together. And the whole reason behind the Radio Alliance is just to basically, if I've got a good guest on my show, like yourself, for instance, what I do then is I just put your email and your Skype into the social, into the Radio Alliance chat. And then any of the radio hosts in there that wish to interview you now have your details and bring you on their shows, give you more coverage, get you out there kind of thing. And
yeah, I appreciate that, Vinny. And I also think that that's a very good methodology and can bring in a just a faster way information to more people, because the people who have information that is useful will just have an easier time finding an audience. You know, as we were just discussing, there is this possibility of a real financial seize up in our future, and I would hope that that there are systems in place that populations can take advantage of, because we're going to need answers, and we're not going to be given them, in my opinion, by the typical media, which in fact will just be there to confuse us.
Yeah. I think that when we talk about the problem with the media kind of thing, it's an overarching one. So it's too gargantuan for any one person to control. Like for instance, Rupert Murdoch. He has no idea what every single one of his newspapers is doing every day, every single one of his news networks, and blah, 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 blah. It's actually just too much for the brain of one person or whatever. But
yeah.
It doesn't mean that a single person can't make a huge impact. And what I think is that in the truth movement, what happens to us, it's either we're born to pretty active parents, so it's inevitable that we become activists, or we're really talented and work well in the establishment until we recognize that it's actually real dangerous, get real badly shafted, then become a real activist about it, right? Do you fit into either of those two categories of an activist?
I'm afraid neither. really was radicalized by my research into Christianity. It just became clear to me that the religion was essentially a psychological operation that had been, committed against the population by the Caesars. And I was able to, as I looked forward, move forward through the religions, went through the religion's history, I could see that this was being used over and over again. It was just this old technique of controlling people. I could see it in play in the modern era, as my example with Bush and the Iraq War. And so once I started to look at government as something that might not be in the interests of citizens, once I really had that insight that, I needed to look at government with fresh eyes, because until then I really had always essentially assumed that there was a legitimate dialectic, that there was, different political positions that were being essentially synthesized, and that the whole process was in some way reflecting the will of the people. After I studied Christianity, I just had a catastrophic emotional experience where I realized that just wasn't the case. And so from there, I began to just take a different understanding of government. And so that was sort of the process that led to how I look at government now, which is essentially that it is, both sides of, at least as the politics that I know best, which is live in the United States. The politics I know are the Democrats and the Republicans. And I just feel at this point that they are really one political party. It's the party of the oligarchs. They put on a pageant, which we call elections. There are slave issues where Obama may be for same-sex marriage and Romney may be opposed to it. But the real issues, the issues that matter to our lives, we just don't have a vote on at this point. So I am hopeful that as people understand the origins of Christianity, that one of the things it'll do is give an incentive for citizens to start to look at governments in general, to start to have some skepticism. I mean, I'll just point out John Key. There is no way, in my opinion, that someone who has a skepticism, that has just asked the basic question of are these candidates possibly representing interests that are not the interests of the citizens, that no one who even asked the question would ever vote for someone like John Key, because his background is so transparently that of someone who works for the oligarchs.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, look at it this way. If you've got some kind of a soldier or SAS or special forces or anything like that, and you assume that the person's not capable of violence, that's basically what voting for John Key is. We'll be right back after the break on thenastyshow.com.
Oh,
Vinny Eastwood Show. I was just recalling just how much I like music and how many different genres I listen to, and it's kind of like I am musically as I am intellectually. There are no frickin' rules. Take your rights back. Take your countries back. This is the important methodology that we now need to follow. Ladies and gentlemen, has any of you wished to escape America? Have any of you wished to escape New Zealand? Have any of you wished to escape the Uber Kingdom or Canada or any of these other Western nations that seem to be descending into tyranny? Where the frack are you going to go? Why do you think they call it a new world order? What are you going to do? Go off world? Try and escape them? No. There's no running anymore. There is only resistance. Joe Atwell is my guest. Welcome back, mate. And you were talking about these people who are withdrawing, preppers and so forth, who are going to live like squirrels underground with their stored food and all of that kind of stuff. And I came up with a joke the other day. What do you call preppers who are preparing for a nuclear winter? Chili preppers.
Yeah, I am very critical of this line of thought. I know people here in the United States that have this idea of a hidey hole. They create, basements with seeds and automatic weapons and, masks for biological contamination. I mean, all sorts of things. Look, this just isn't a viable solution. What we need to do is to stand our ground. And what I tell people whenever I'm given the question is to say, look, the energy you put into these absurd activities, which will go nowhere and certainly aren't going to stop the drones from finding you and destroying you if they choose to, you should be putting into political activity. I think the critical flaw, and I think it's really the result of our political experience, is that so many of us are individualistic. We don't have communities. We don't have friends. What the prepper should be doing is finding another prepper, and the two of them should be trying to communicate to two others. And then that group, rather than getting a hidey hole, they should be going down to the street corner and trying to organize people politically. Explain what you're afraid of to the people on the street. Get the people to be aware of the same problems that the prepper is. And many times the prepper has the first understanding. They're the most paranoid. They should take that energy and try to make it into a real political resistance and not just run away and try to escape from coming doom. Fight it. Don't try to flee from it.
Well, and again, this comes down to a very basic human thing. It's about fight or flight response. Okay, now the reason why you have a fight or flight response depends upon what is attacking you. Like, let's say, for example, you've got a bear coming at you. You do not have sufficient weaponry to take it down. You do not have a large enough spear. You do not have seven or eight other hunters with you in order to corral, taunt, tire the bear out, and then stab it to death. Okay, you don't have that. So you got to run as fast as you can, get where that bear can't get you. However, if it's a cheetah, and who can run 100 miles an hour, you think you're going to be able to run? Hell no. You got to fight. And it doesn't matter how hard you fight or whatever, it doesn't seem like a fair fight. Yet, you look at history, and it matters not who the bigger side is, the most prepared or whatever. There's an element of chance, an element of luck, I think an element of fate when it comes to wars to free people. If you take successful wars to free people, the one I like to use most commonly being the American Revolution, which was facilitated in no small part by the pamphleteers, the introduction of the printing press, and also due to a high level of literacy at the time, about 70%, which is actually more than Americans are literate today. There was a intellectual capacity there for people to learn an issue, understand it, and then take steps in order to subvert that negativity from continuing. Okay, this is the birth of revolutions. Once people realize that there is a problem, once they have something to rally behind or whatever, that's when you start to improve society. Not before then, on the other hand. I think that we're simply the modern pamphleteers, and the world is the modern new world, America. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
We're trying to... It's kind of like a global republic that we're trying to do, but except instead of trying to bring the globe together in a governmental fashion, we're trying to bring the people of the globe together, exit out the finance, exit out the religion, exit out the politicians and all their lying BS, because none of them have mattered, okay, or at least not in a good way, for quite some time. Now we're the ones who should be running society, and I think that we have the technology to make everybody completely independent and not need government, not need these major mega death corporations and what have you, because we have the ability now to survive without them. We don't need them anymore, and I think that's why they're ramping up so much crap in this day and age. They may have figured out that they're obsolete now.
Yeah, first of all, I think it's a very good analogy. I think the fight or flight choice should be based upon the right information. I mean, you would handle a cheetah differently than a brown bear that weighed 1,500 pounds. So the first thing you have to do is determine what exactly you're fighting and what is the best chance that you have. I would say that information needs to be put out in the most effective way. And the best model of this, I know, is Iceland. Iceland had a successful rebellion against the bankers, and this came about democratically, more or less. But at the foundation of the rebellion was these very small information exchanging groups that Iceland has historically developed. So the level of information exchange was very small, in other words, in terms of the people involved in these groups. And in such groups, I think you get a real clear way of exchanging the best information. So the first thing that I would hope happens is that people, particularly those who have the paranoid streak, would use the energy to try to organize at a small level. And then the second thing is that we need to exchange information internationally. I think that what is going on in Greece and what went on in Iceland, these are stories and information that people in New Zealand and in Los Angeles need. Everyone needs to know these pieces of information, because that's how they're going to be able to make the right choice in terms of how to respond to fight or flight. You need to have the best information. So The one thing I would hope is that groups in Greece, for example, could reach out to you and give you really good data on exactly how the banking crisis occurred, on who was behind it, on what percent of the so-called bailout money is going to the people and what is being returned to the bankers to pay interest on notes that were created out of thin air in the first place. In other words, Greece should be giving Iceland information because that will, Greece should be giving New Zealand information because that will help New Zealanders understand their future and how to avoid it. And Iceland should be giving New Zealand information, and it should be giving Los Angeles information, because this was an example where there was a successful resistance. So these are the just kinds of things I'm hoping will occur at a faster and faster pace. The more the crisis onsets, the colder and hungrier people get, the greater the energy will be to have this information communicated, but there will be momentum. So that small efforts now could be enormous results later on, as the energy among the citizens is created through breakdowns in the food supply and the financial systems.
I mean, one person in wintertime would think, oh, one little snowball's not going to do much damage. You roll that snowball down the hill and you get it started earlier on, you can create something that's so massive you can crush a car with it.
Amen, brother. That's exactly right. That's why just everyone that understands this reality should be working, supporting, and doing everything you can to get shows like yours out to more and more people.
Yeah, that's part of my New Year's resolution. 2012, time to stop fracking around.
That's right.
Yeah, we don't have much of a choice. And the idea is there's an Achilles heel to the New World Order. There must be. Or at the very least, an Achilles heel to each individual agenda. Let's say they've got 1,000 agendas. It means there's 1,000 ways to take them out. And the interesting thing about waking up to conspiracy is you recognize the connections between these 1,000 different conspiracies and what have you. So the only reason why they exist and persist is because they operate under a systemic methodology. Now, that means that all conspiracies essentially suffer from the precise same weakness. So if you have a weakness that gets exploited by the people and a government that is overthrown in a successful manner, it means that precise methodology, whatever those people used in order to get those scumbags out, can be replicated in other areas because the New World Order has replicated itself and hence has the same weaknesses. So we can share our strengths just like they share their weaknesses. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, hour number two, with Joe Atwell coming up. And we'll also have Freda X popping in, who's been studying the Catholic Church since like the 80s. Back in a minute. Alert the masses. Baby, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And it really is the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, okay? Dig this. My missus, and it's going to be our six-year anniversary tomorrow, and it's my mum's birthday tonight. I've got to go over and, you know, do the sun thing and whatever. What was I going to say? I forgot. All right. Anyway, we're talking about methodologies and the methodology of scumbaggery. When I look at any institution, and it's become almost patently that black and white, almost any institution now that you see, some kind of sociopath at the top, couple of proto-sociopaths under him that pass down his orders to the dumbass minions down the bottom. So you've got a society run exactly like that, because every single institution follows that very similar structure and methodology. So that way, you have the worst ideas of crazy psychos becoming government policy, financial policy, religious policy, whatever policy. Okay, this is what produces it. And I am not 100% sure exactly solve each and every issue. But the truth movement in itself, I find, solves that problem on its own, because you have a look at all these different fields of eclectic conspiratorial research, guys. And what I found is for every one particular issue, even if it's incredibly cryptic and nobody knows about it, there is always at least one guy who knows everything about it and what have you. But maybe people don't know who that person is. What I think, and I think, Joe, you kind of put this point forward earlier and wholeheartedly with you on it, is that you need to share resources and give all these different people coverage. Now, I've been criticized because I claim that I don't have any credibility.
and I don't do research on my guests before having them on. And apparently, if I do, and I don't challenge my guests either, like if they say something that I don't believe in or I think it sounds crazy, I'm just like, okay, it's your opinion. And I don't kind of challenge people on the show or whatever. It's not an adversarial show. I mean, you'd be more accurate to think of me as kind of like a truther prostitute. Okay, I proselytize for all the different people in the truth movement, and just like a hooker, I ain't picky. Okay, I set the bar really low. If you are a listener to the show and you want to see me interview someone, you're my boss. That person's email, I get them on the show, just like has done with 99.999% of these guests that we have on the show every day. No idea who they are, but you do. The listeners. And so that is the methodology that I follow. If you keep listening to many, 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 many different voices that you maybe have never heard before, are unfamiliar with, you then gain perspective. And through gaining perspective, you gain discernment. Because if you rely on your radio show host of choice to be your sole source of information, your sole source of intellectual discernment, then you are killing yourself intellectually. You are not allowing yourself the capacity to think and discern for yourself, and you will simply be a truther slave rather than a sleeping slave. You know, it's no point. Wake up and listen to more people if you can. Sorry, guys, for going on that little rant. We have Freda X joining us now. Well, Freda, welcome.
Hey, I was just going to say, I think I recall you coming on my show and giving me grief about not letting the guest talk, doing exactly what you just did. Just for the record, anyway, I wanted to point that out. I'm just going to sit out there. But no, I'm really, really excited to be here. I am a big fan of Mr. Atwell here. He's come upon, I think, an amazing thesis. His work is really exciting, very intriguing. I have really enjoyed your interviews with Jan Ervin over at Gnostic Media. Wow, great job, sir. Really excellent work.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll tell you, I want to just make a shout-out right away to the Confederacy of Anons in the chat room out there, keeping us all humble. Thank you, guys, everybody out there. You're awesome. But anyways, back to the point. Boy, I tell you, I was saying to Joe here when we were waiting for the show to come back on during the break that, you know, I experienced, I think, a similar background coming up, you know, being a believer. I was a Christian. I was first a Catholic until I was 18, and then I joined a non-denominational church that lived according to the Book of Acts. Basically, by all accounts, you'd call it a cult. It was a small church where they were really just, you know, I realized after a couple of years of being associated with them that it was a thought-stopping system of mind control. And then I was troubled, though, because I had faith, you know, that was sort of woven up with emotions, and I felt the crisis of the condemnation of my peers when I decided to announce I was leaving the church, you know, and they left me as a young man, you know. Feeling walking around thinking I was damned for a few years and really acting like, well, hell, if you can't lower heaven, then raise hell. You might as well, you know, do whatever you want because you're damned already, you know. And I led a very self-destructive path for a while because of it. But then my intellect kicked in and I studied and I learned and I read books like one of the first books that really woke me up was by a man named Holder Kirsten, who did a lot of Shroud Turin work. He wrote a book called The Jesus Conspiracy and another one called Jesus Lived in India. And when I found out there was a whole wealth of information about traditions about Jesus all over the world, I was like, wait a second, what is this? And so, yeah, you know, I started to, you know, formulate what I believe is the same thesis, only, you know, with slight variations. You've got some very original ideas, Joe. I wouldn't want to take those away from you. But I you know, the big picture about what we're dealing with here, that I always assumed that Paul was a character in this. You postulate he was also fictitious, correct?
Yeah, there were three really significant miracle-working Jews of the era, Flavius Josephus, the character Jesus Christ, and Paul. and all of them are, you know, have a very pro-Roman perspective in their theology and worldview. And so just out of hand, you can almost certainly realize that they're, because this just wasn't going on in the messianic movement of the time. The messianic movement of the first century was militaristic, xenophobic, and waged war against Rome. It wasn't this Christian image that appears in the Gospels and in Paul's writing. So, you know, I think that, you know, they have been sort of ossified over the years, and people now, you know, they think of Paul or Jesus just as, you know, as real as members of their families, but it really can't stand any scrutiny. These are fictional characters.
Yeah, you know, and of course, thank the Lord for the Dead Sea Scrolls,
right,
and the light that it brings to everyone. Every Christian listening to this radio show right now, you need to go out and buy yourself a copy of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Fragments, the Nag Hammadi Library, and read, just read, you know, versions of the Bible that weren't contaminated, at least, you know, I'm sure they were contaminated when they got into those book form there, but less contaminated, let's say, than the material we know as the Holy Canon, the Bible. But also,
yeah,
it's interesting the three men you bring up, because two of those men claimed to be Flavians, didn't they?
Flavius Josephus claimed to be a Flavian. Paul had
many interactions. He claimed to be a Herod, didn't he?
That claim comes from a passage which, in one of his letters, he talks to an individual who is of the family of Herod, and he calls him my kinsman.
Yes.
And so, from that, a number of people have deduced that the character, you know, was from the Herod family, which was very much entwined with the Flavian family.
Sure.
So
that was the
that's kind of the general connection that Paul has to the Flavian.
So are you proposing? I haven't finished your book, but are you proposing that Josephus was also a fictional character?
Sure. If you just look at the attributes that he claims for himself, I mean, just to list a few, you know, he was a child prodigy. He was a member of all three sects of the Jews at the time. He was a general for the rebellion against the Romans. Then he was captured by these, and at which point he had a communication with God, who told him that the covenant between the Jews and God was broken, and now the covenant would exist between the Romans and the Jews. So he then has these prophecies about Vespasian becoming Caesar. This isn't a real character. What you have, actually, if you just sort of take the aspects of the individual part, what you see is that whoever created the character was just deliberately producing an individual who would have so much essentially credibility in terms of understanding the era that no one could cast doubt on the history he was writing. In other words, the history he was producing was propaganda. And the people who wanted the propaganda to be taken seriously created an author that was simply beyond criticism. No human would have all of the attributes that Josephus claimed for himself.
You know, I just always considered him a liar.
One thing that's believable about
him. Well, it wouldn't be the first time that a liar became a big religious figure, would it?
Or historian, for that matter.
No, no, but yeah, the Gospels and the histories of Josephus are actually a unified body of literature. They both come from the same literary team. It wasn't one individual, and they used nom de plumes because they wanted the literature to be more realistic. I mean, once the character Jesus Christ is completely understood as fictional, then Josephus and Paul, they've just become very easy to identify as fictional characters.
Okay, so let me ask you just another question, if I could.
Sure.
Why do you think that the Maccabees were removed from the Protestant Bible and not removed from the Catholic one?
You know, I don't know. That's a very good question. I've always kind of wondered about the whole Maccabean literature. It's very mysterious. I really don't have any understanding of that. I know that the Maccabees were essentially the in back of the organization that Rome was fighting against.
And Greece, right? Greece before them, right?
And Greece before them, yeah. So you have a, you know, this very long-standing struggle between the, you know, Greco-Roman world and this particular movement by a family, and the family claimed to be a messianic family. And so, you know, I'm able to decode the Gospels very, very well, and also the Pauline material in Revelation. In my next book, I show what all that stuff is. That's very easy for me to understand. The Maccabean literature is very complicated. I would go back to a point you made earlier. Just the best way to understand that is to read the Dead Sea Scrolls, because yes. Then you're reading the straight dope. You're reading the autobiographical information, and you're seeing the real time, you know, messianic movement and what they believed. And so, if you read that stuff, that would be, you know, where I'd begin to try to understand the current Maccabean literature.
And did you know that Mel Gibson was supposedly working on a new movie about the Maccabees?
I did. And in fact, I actually ran into Mel Gibson about 2 months ago. I mean, physically. he had his daughter on his shoulders, and he was at a beach club that I belonged to, and I was exercising. I came out the door, and he bumped into me. The daughter almost fell. He turned around, and I was astounded to see it was Mel Gibson. We didn't exchange words, but I'm hoping that he'll put me in the movie.
I don't want to capitalize on this whole show. This is Vinny's show, but I just had one more question, and then I'll shut up. I'm sorry, but and I'd love to have you come on my show, which
Happy
is the Middle Chamber
anytime.
On this network. And I know that Sonic, who's in the chat room right now, would love to have you come on Type One Radio Lounge as well.
Yeah. Great,
but,
great.
My question is: are you familiar with the works of Zachariah Sitchin? And
no.
And also, are you familiar with the works of John Lamb Lash, who wrote a book called Not in His Image?
Yes.
An analysis of the Nag Hammadi Library. And I would like to know your thoughts on his thesis.
Wow. I would have a very complicated, nuanced response. In general, I tend to agree with it.
Okay, so,
I think the Nag Hammadis, they're just fascinating, particularly in light of the analysis that I do in part of what the original Gospels are, because Nag Hammadi seems in some ways to be a kind of reaction against the authoritative structure that the Gospels represent. And so
how about the Archons and the depiction of the Archons within? What do you think about that?
Oh, man. you know, I have opinions, but I just don't have enough real detail to give anything of value to the audience.
okay.
I don't mean to be circumspect, but because of my position in the Gospels and how focused it is and how narrowly you know, sort of concentrated, I'm often asked to try to go broader in other areas of Christian scholarship and of historical. Kind of feel it's just not my place. I mean, I have a narrow, clearly defined area, and I just sort of reside my analysis there. I even try to stay away from, you know, esoteric sort of interpretations of the Gospels. If you've read Caesar's Messiah, the first part of it, you know that I have a very narrow range of understanding that has to do with a clear linkage, a typologic linkage between the Gospels and the history that Flavian Josephus wrote. So basically, the ministry of Jesus was based upon the military campaign of Titus Flavius. And all of these events in the Gospels, they essentially look forward to Titus's campaign. It was a way that the Flavians could essentially become the Christ of the Jews, because the character in the Gospels that Jesus predicts, who he refers to as the Son of Man, who's going to come and they're going to have this destruction of the Galilean towns and Jerusalem will be encircled, the temple buildings will be razed. That is the reason for the Gospels writing, is that Titus Flavius actually ends up being this character that Jesus predicts coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. All right. We're going to get the same old moldy tyranny that we've had before if we think that the next one is going to be a different Flavian. They're not. They're the same Flavian. We'll be right back after the break at TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com.
Thank you. There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
I think this is an appropriate song. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio, the show that's all about history repeating. And one of my favourite callers of all time has called in, as I asked him to, because he always has a great perspective. The Greek, welcome to the program. The Greek, you're on air, man. All right, seem to have a problem with the phones. Greek, if you want to just quickly hang up and ring back in, I'll unmute you again. And he has a unique perspective on the Bible, religion, in general, and what have you. And what I find is that basically the more esoteric the knowledge becomes, it's almost like the more useless the knowledge becomes, if you know what I mean. Like, in a way, the more you know, the less you're capable of doing, because you're spending all that time maintaining that knowledge and reading up and that kind of stuff, rather than creating new things or whatever. At least this is what I do. Is I think that learning as much as you can is a good methodology. However, you also have to do as much as you can and produce something fruit. Otherwise, if it's not applied, it's almost like it was irrelevant learning it in the first place.
Yeah, and it's very very good point in the context of our discussion, because one of the things that keeps Christianity in place is that it's completely incomprehensible. I mean, the Gospels are so mysterious; they can be understood in so many different ways. And of course, they were written in Greek, which is a language that 98% of the people who actually read the things are not familiar with. So the priests then have this power that they are only they can actually interpret the words in the right way and give you the truth of what the literature has to offer. And one of the things that I've tried to do with my book, Caesar's Messiah, is to show that you don't need to have that kind of esoteric understanding to come to an absolutely clear position that Jesus is a fictional character. Try to show that the events of his life are so transparently based on other stories. They are not history. They are actually just derived, that a common reader with a half hour of normal work can get to a really good understanding of it. And then from that point, they should be immune to the use of the character and of religion, Christianity, in a political context. After come understanding that there's a really good basis for seeing the character as fictional, then the politicians that come forward and they have Christianity in their bag of tricks that they can use to fool you, they're not going to be as successful. Because remember, the politicians that use Christianity, they have this ability to gather not just Christians, but people who are sort of sharing in other political contexts, similar ideas. But if you look at them as having and this is because Christianity is sort of normalized. It's kind of an accepted, well, every sort of person that is a reasonable guy can also be Christian. Once you see the religion as being completely fictional and essentially, a psychop operation of government, then the politician that uses it doesn't have it any longer as a way to justify crazy. You can't kind justify like crazy using Christianity any longer.
Kind of like if you expose the whole methodology of false flag terrorism, you remove the ability of the New World Order to use that to manipulate people.
Yeah, if the population is sensitive to false flag terrorists, then they are harder to fool, for sure, of course.
Mm. Okay, the Greek, you are there now?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, right. Yeah, great. I just wanted to say, first of all, the necessary aspect of what you call religion is there to pretty much maintain control, because if it wasn't there, society is about an onion skin's width away from being in total barbarism. And who was it that said that the common man is best ruled with a heavy hand? So it is an element of control, number one. Number two, the people are the problem that society and that has, it's a very, very deep problem, is that there's a mixing, and the people have in their minds that religions such as Christianity, Judaism, or any religion has anything to do supposedly with the text that they allegedly subscribe to. Typically what happens is when you have someone who's a member of a religion, whatever religion, it doesn't matter whether it's Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, once that person who subscribes to that religion takes some time and actually reads the text, and let's not get into the confusion, well, you know, you're not supposed to take it literally. Well, let's just say that you read it word for word with some element of comprehension. I assure you, you will want nothing to do with the people that call themselves for whatever religion that you had initially subscribed to. So what I'm trying to say here is if someone calls themselves a Christian and they actually sit down and study the Bible, but don't bring the Christian imagery into it, just read it with comprehension, you will want nothing to do with Christianity. If you are into Judaism and you study, let's say, the Torah, you will want nothing to do with anything that's taught in Judaism, so on and so forth, for every religion. Now, this is a human phenomenon. It's not an academic phenomenon, or I believe it's deeply ingrained socially, but it is something to do with the species. It's almost a level of madness that exists and has existed for thousands of years that hopefully in the next decade or two we'll break out of. So, arguing about religion and the Bible, the two have nothing to do with each other, but it's safe to say that most people have not read the Bible, or the Quran, or the Torah, or the Bhagavad Gita, or the Mahabharata for the Hindus. So it's much more convenient to fall into the social herd mentality and agree with the despots that rule these religions.
Well, I would say to the first point in terms of religion and social control, I would agree. I don't think it's a very good one. I think that if you just look at, you know, for example, the 20th century, in the wars that Christianity was involved with, it's just hard for me to imagine that there isn't a better form of control than the one that, you know, produced that century. And I think if you look at the way that the Christian nations are currently dealing with their financial structure, I just think we can do better than this. And I think that I also would point that the way Christianity is used as social control is just wrong at this point. It isn't producing a more, benign society. I gave an example earlier in the show. I don't know if you heard it about Bush and his use of Bush's Book of Revelation. I mean, I think that it is easy to imagine society, you know, disintegrating or even getting worse if you remove all religion from it overnight. But I also think that far more likely is that society would benefit tremendously, and it would take us quite a while to go through the whole argument, but that is simply my position. In terms of reading, I would point out just one point where you're factually wrong. If you actually converse or exchange information with Talmudic Jews or Jews in the rabbinical tradition, and I do this all the time, you would be astounded at the level of of comprehension of their literature that they have. Astonishing. And so,
I understand. I would agree with you on the Talmud, but they don't look at the Torah, what would be the Torah, the first five books, Pentateuch, let's say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've devised a method to go around it and create very long interpretations where the actual text, the Torah, the Talmud, was very concise and precise. And they've derived a series of cliff notes that are longer than the actual original text. Then they talk about the text.
Right, the Parsharim, right, the commentaries.
Yeah, that's right.
Correct. And they've twisted it around. They twist it around to the point where, for example, it says don't eat pork in the Torah. And they'll say, well, you see, it didn't say anything about restaurants or at home. So maybe it's okay to eat pork at restaurants. You see what I mean? That's just a point.
Sure. They have tremendous disagreements among themselves, but they do not come out of a lack of reading material. That I can assure you. And I also would point out that I am in contact with some what I would call fundamental Christian groups, particularly in terms of the Book of Revelation, which I have an analysis that I share with them and I'll be bringing out in a subsequent book. And their understanding of the Gospels and Revelation is essentially encyclopedic.
I agree.
I would say that, yeah, this is true in a general sense, that most Christians have never put any time into reading the Gospels. But there are some that have a tremendous amount of time put into reading it. And the problem is, the ones that read it tend to be, and particularly who read it incorrectly, in my opinion, they tend to be the ones that have the most influence. And, I mean, if, for example, I'll give you John Hagee. He is, in my opinion, clinically insane, and yet he is the most influential spiritual advisor to the Republican Party. All of the Republican nominees
And again, he wouldn't be the first crazy religious person.
Well, the thing is that he's not even seen as crazy. I mean, he's even though he is so believing the details of the Book of Revelation. That because it mentions a red heifer, you know, a blemishless calf will be born.
Oh, the red calf, yes.
He's attempting to.
This goes back to my original comment where it's all taken out of context, bits and pieces. I want to just put in a parting shot because I don't want to argue one point or another. I just want to see. My point here is to help people, but you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him think. Don't worry about the horse drinking. He's going to get thirsty eventually, right? So my point here is, if I could just drop a biscuit and move along as a parting shot, if I give you a recipe for, let's say, chocolate chip cookies, and it has some basic parameters, let's say pound cake, a pound of flour, a pound of butter, a pound of this, and you heat the oven to 350, if you do those things, you will end up with the result of what the recipe was prescribed to produce or the information is being conveyed. And let me give you a parting shot. This is anyone who's even if you haven't read the Bible, you will see this to be true. You have this figure called the Messiah in Scripture, and the Christians have hijacked this concept. And when you go into any of their institutions or their literature, the first thing they put in front of you is a guy with long hair nailed to a cross wearing a loincloth. And I'm being polite, I usually say a diaper, okay? That's the first image they put in front of you. Now, I assure you that is that did not happen at all, biblically or historically. And you can prove it both ways. The easiest way to prove it is biblically. Even if you haven't read the Bible, people know that the legal method of execution in the Bible is death by stoning. Okay? Second of all, when you get to what they call the Gospels, if you read it, the Roman man in control did not want anything to do with it. He even publicly washed his hands, which is a symbol meaning I will not do anything with this man, declared him innocent. And he actually turned around to the Judean authorities and said, you have a law, use your law, I'm making this exception. So what they did was they went to the law, and in Deuteronomy 21 it says you're to be nailed to a tree and stoned to death. Okay? So what does that have to do with the Roman cross, and what does that have to do with this character that they're showing three crosses? It was basically three men on one almond tree that were stoned to death for 6 hours. This is very easy. This is all in the text. But no one reads it with any comprehension. And when I say no one, I mean very few people through the ages. It's kind of like the whole thing with 9/11. You could sit and argue whether or not a bunch of guys with box cutters or this or that or whatever, till the cows come home or till you're blue in the face, if you actually just stop and read the 9/11 Commission report, you will see none of it makes any sense. You don't need to argue.
Right. I'd like
Is
to comment.
Somebody arguing
on...
here, though? Sorry. I just. Right. I mean, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to comment on the crucifixion story. It is actually based on history. In the Gospels look forward 40. So the stories that you read in them are actually based on events that happened 40 years later. and that was during the war. And if you read Josephus, you'll see that during the war, they captured a Messiah on the Mount of Olives, and the Romans did crucify him. Then he was crucified in a group of three, and an individual, not Joseph of Arimathea, but Joseph Bar-Matthias.
Okay, hold on a second. Hold on. Is that actually in the text, though? Is that in the text? It's not.
It's not
in the text.
It's in Josephus, yeah. In other words,
in other words, what I'm saying is, if I give you a simple chocolate chip cookie recipe or a pound cake recipe, we can't start discussing a review written about it without actually reading the recipe. But what I'm assuring you is that if you actually study the text, what they call the New Testament or the Gospel, it has nothing to do with what's being put out in Christianity at all. It is all application of Mosaic law, and it has nothing. Again, you can't mix the two. It doesn't mix.
Well, do you know what?
Sorry, guys, we're coming to break now. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Freda, Greg, thanks for coming on. We'll just do the final segment coming up, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know
about... You listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show, the most contaminated 2 hours in talk radio. We produce depleted uranium right here at the Vinny Eastwood Show facility. Lawrence Livermore, Vinny Eastwood, yeah. And we have a couple of callers. And before we go to you guys, I'm sorry, we're going to have to have you holding on for a little bit. I wanted to ask my stock standard final question of my guest. It's about self-censorship. And you know how whenever we go on radio or TV or anything where you've got a large audience or whatever, you understand that there's an enormous amount of possible misinterpretation or non-comprehension or judgment that might come across by either the audience or the interviewer. So we choose to stay away from particular subjects, even though we feel very open and honest, and if somebody asks us, we'll talk about it. But the problem is we don't find people who are actually willing to ask and just be sitting and willing to listen and not judge and just allow you to talk about whatever you want to talk about and give you the opportunity at the very least. So if you have anything along those lines, Joe, go for your life.
Thank you. I'm really an open book. One of the things about my thesis that is actually very useful for people who are reading it is that everything that I produce is based on real evidence. In other words, there are lots of theories of Christian origins that have just these conjectures. You know, you have these ideas of like there was a community that the gospel writer Luke had, and then there was another community that Mark had, and they had all these fantasies. What I show is actually based on real text, the typologic system, and I know it's a complicated term, but the system that I show exists is real. There's no way that it can be controverted. And so I don't really, you know, have stuff actually that is hidden or that I worry about discussing. The only thing is that I try to get people to come into the work at a level that isn't offensive to their emotional sensibilities, because a lot of the Roman humor, a lot of the stuff in the Gospels that I show is really dark. And so I always try to just... so that people will have an open mind to the information, not start there. I don't start with the blackest stuff. I start with just the simple relationship between Jesus's ministry, Titus's campaign, and I show that Jesus's ministry cannot possibly be history. It's based on the military campaign of a Roman Caesar.
Do you want to elaborate further on any of the comedy or darkness?
Well, I mean, the one that I most often, people are very upset by is the fact that when you go through the events in Jesus's ministry, you have these events which are essentially they foresee the future, right? They're like Jesus makes very specific prophecies that are going to curse about the Galilean towns will be destroyed, Jerusalem will be encircled, the temple will be razed, there will be an abomination of desolation. These are all military victories of the Flavian campaign, right? He gives them in the same order they occurred actually in fact. But there are other things that, for example, the Last Supper, where Jesus says that, you shall eat of my flesh or drink of my blood or you won't have any life in you. Now, that relates to an experience during the war, and in the war, the Romans used the classic technique of encircling the city and then having starvation set in. So I don't want to go into much to the parallels, but you can see it gets to a very black place. And because Jesus is such an iconic character, and because he is beloved by so many people, it's just an area that I really don't of this simple history that I give in the beginning of the book. So, you know, I'm never afraid to talk about the coherency of the really black humor in the Gospels. It's just I don't like to do it at the beginning because it's just not the right way to get someone who's first coming across my information to have an open mind regarding it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you're going to train a soldier, you don't put a gun in his hand and march him into battle
exactly.
without training.
That's it. Yeah. So I don't hide. It's a sequence that I prefer to go through the information in.
Okay, well, let's go to our callers then. We still have the Greek holding on the line. We'll give you a minute or two more to finish up your original point that you were doing, because Joe actually wanted to address what you said. And we also have Sean on the line as well, so we want to get to him as quickly as possible before we finish the show up. Greek, are you still there?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here. Okay. My point was, I agree and I disagree with the guest. His point about the Romans encircling, yes, absolutely. And if you read the Gospels, what's called the Gospels, they're not what you think they are. They're actually much darker and much more violent, at least projected violence, than most people are told in what they call a church. But I gave a parting shot before to explain how what they're showing, the Christians are showing as the Messiah is completely biblically illegal. I want to give another point. The Christians have something called the Ten Commandments, and the ones that they talk about were never written in stone. Those were verbal directions when they came to the base of Mount Sinai. It was basically behavioral instructions, kind of like when you go to a store and it says no shirt, no shoes, no service. They didn't want to go up to the mountain, so Moses went up to the mountain by himself to get the commandments written on stone. The commandments that most people think were written on stone were not. If you go to what's called Exodus 34 and just read that chapter, you will see what was actually written on the stone. And if you have any kind of a Christian background, you're not familiar with any of them. So again, this is a point that's taken out of context. And it's also propagandized through movies like The Ten Commandments by Cecil B. DeMille. And all these other things. If you read the text also, it'll show you the stones were so small he held both in one hand, not these big tombstones. So, again, we're talking about a situation here where the guest can be 100% correct about what he's saying on the parallels, but because very little of it is actually based on the actual document, and most of it's based on what other people have written, that part is true. But if you actually stick to the document, the biblical document, you will see that what religions are doing, let's say Christianity and Judaism, it's not here at all.
I'm sorry to cut you short, but we really don't have much time to keep going into
Thanks.
This, so we're going to have to jump to our next caller, bro. Thanks very much for your call.
Thanks.
Sean, welcome to the program.
Hello, Professor Eastwood. This is Sean Gallagher, the chiropractor I talked to you about a couple of weeks ago, or actually a couple of months ago. How are you?
I'm really good, Sean. Well, how are you, man?
Excellent, excellent. Your guest is right on, and I think if most people were to understand that Buddha actually advocated everything that Christ talked about, there's an old saying, the Hare Krishna. I really believe that the Vatican, if you really look at everything that they did, they were kind of dirty. And for anything that they really say, it's hard to believe them. You know, they what they did with the Crusades and going to America with the Bible in one hand and a sword in the other. But there was a lot of good things in the Bible, but it's hard to take it literal. I mean, Santo Bernacchi, I believe his name was, he really talked... Yes, he really talked about how the Catholic Church took Buddhism along with astrology and kind of made their own little version of it. But basically, the positive thing of the Bible is forgive, forget, love all. But my whole point being here is that, again, if you look at Muhammad and Buddha, they were very into diet, lots of fruits and vegetables. They were anti-meat. They were anti-alcohol. They were love. They were forgive and forget. And I think that that's one thing that we have to understand is that it's very hard to take the Bible literally when you actually look at what the Catholic Church has done throughout the centuries. You see what I'm saying?
I have to agree with you there, and I was thinking about this actually yesterday, so it was kind of synchronous that we'd have Joe on today, about my religious beliefs, and I thought to myself, man, I believe in some things out of the Bible, some things out of the Buddha, some things out of this, that, and the other. So, like, there's bits that I find are correct, parts of religions are correct all across the board, and so what I do is just combine those pieces from all those different eclectic religions, and that becomes my religious doctrine sort of thing, but I change it whenever it seems to be wrong. And I think that this is the problem with religions, is because in my conclusion, if every single one of them has bits that are right, it means that every single one of them is wholly wrong.
I agree 100%. But again, you can never go wrong with forgive all. And one thing about the Bible I do agree with, if you can think about this, we know, Professor Eastwood, that people are sick through diet and through drugs and through chemtrails, through false media, that people are sick. We can agree upon that. And what did the Bible say? But what did the Bible say real quickly? Forgive them, for they do not know what they do. So how can you condemn somebody if they are sick? And a real enlightened being would forgive a person that is sick. Would you not agree?
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I'm against the drug war as well, because it's a health issue, and you don't lock people up who are sick to be good for their health, do you? All right, and I think the same context applies here. Thank you so much, Sean, for your call, man. And you have yourself a lovely afternoon.
Thank you.
And Joe, of course, thank you very much for joining us. And what I'd like you to do just before we go in the last 30 seconds or so is just quickly give out your websites and the name of your book so people can come and find you.
Right. Well, the book is called Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus. You can go to caesarsmessiah.com, and you'll also find a number of ways to communicate with me, ask questions. There is a lot of other things that are going on. You can also go to caesarsmessiahdoc.com and get information about the documentary. There's a documentary made about Caesar's Messiah that has
we've only got five.
And it's going to be on the 28th of September.